Welcome to Undivided. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We'll have a lot of election coverage this week, obviously for Washington voters and for a lot of voters across the country. Ballots are in hand. And so certainly I hope that you're taking time to review those, even if you don't get them in right away. Make sure you get them in before November 8th. A few things today. We're going to talk about the candidate forum that was held between U.S. Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat, and her Republican challenger, Tiffany Smiley. This is a race that is now getting a lot of national attention. I've said all along, I think it's going to be very hard to beat Senator Murray, who is running for her sixth term. She's been in the Senate for 30 years. But since Patty Murray refused any official debates put on by the coalition, I did want to go through this candidate forum, how both candidates performed and some of the standout moments. So we'll do that coming up in a moment. Also, I'll have a follow-up on a massive homeless encampment, perhaps the largest in Washington state, which is all the way over in Spokane. I got my hands on some internal documents from the governor's office that reveal the true priority of our elected officials when it comes to getting this camp dealt with. It may surprise you, it may not surprise you, but I will tell you it is government at its finest. Also, the left says it's the party for people of color, for women, for members of the LGBTQ plus community. But apparently that's only if those individuals will fall in line with the Democratic Party. I'll have some examples of that. But let's start with the Patty Murray, Tiffany Smiley candidate form. So as I have been saying for the last couple weeks, Patty Murray refused to participate in any official coalition-sanctioned debates. So a debate to me is different than a candidate forum. It's different than a town hall. A debate is the two candidates side by side in a stage, moderated, where the moderator has a lot of latitude to ask follow-up questions, to do fact-checking in the moment. I think, as I've said, this is the most effective way to gauge a candidate's qualifications, how they handle themselves under pressure, body language, all of that is so important in a debate setting. So anyway, there was a candidate forum in Spokane between these two candidates that was put on by the League of Women Voters and the Spokesman Review. And look, it was fine in terms of the format. You know, I'll talk about that quickly. It was someone from the Spokesman Review. I thought she did a fine job, but really, they covered a lot of ground, but there was no fact-checking in real time, no follow-ups. And so in that sense, it's just sort of like giving the candidates a little time to sit there. I mean, they're sitting down, the moderator's between them on stage, and so you don't get that kind of interaction you want between the two candidates. But yeah, covered a lot of ground. I thought a lot of the questions were good. I don't think there was enough focus on topics like crime. And then there was no follow-up questions. And so you're not really holding them accountable for their answers, which is disappointing. But anyway, still good to see the two candidates on stage. Again, I don't like that they're seated. I think that that's a little weird. I like what you get from a body language and standing. I think it just becomes a different kind of environment. Anyway, the two strategies of the candidates were so transparent to me. I'm not saying they're bad strategies. I'm just saying that it was very obvious kind of the approach that both ladies went into this with, because it was woven throughout the entirety of the debate. So for Tiffany Smiley, her approach was really to paint Patty Murray as a Washington, D.C. Beltway insider whose time in the Senate has expired.
Career politicians, they like to use immigration as a political wedge when it comes to election time. Well, that sounds like a Washington, D.C. answer to me. I took on Washington, D.C., Patty, and I won. You've never taken on Washington, D.C. You are Washington, D.C. I'm here to fight for Washington State. Senator Murray stands up for Washington, D.C.
Thank you.
You know, Senator Murray, you're not the mom in tennis shoes anymore. It's been 30 years. You've become a career politician.
Patty Murray's strategy was a little more nuanced, but I definitely caught it. And I don't know if it was intentional strategy or just how she views Tiffany Smiley, but it was very much to act as if Tiffany Smiley is completely out of her depth in all of this, has no idea what she's talking about. You saw that reflected in the way that Patty Murray would often react to Tiffany Smiley's answers.
I do every day, Tiffany, obviously. How much can I correct in 30 seconds? Like I'm listening to Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor. So let me take a breath.
So anyway, those were the two strategies that you really found throughout the debate. But for those of you who didn't have a chance to watch the hour-long debate, again, this is a race that is now getting national attention across the country. Republicans believe they can flip this seat. I think that's going to be incredibly hard. But the fact that you have Patty Murray spending so much money, you have her bringing surrogates into Washington, shows that there is a little concern there. So anyway, let me play a portion of each of their opening statements.
This is one of the most consequential elections of our lifetime. Women's rights are on the ballot. If you send me back a pro-choice Senate, I will work to pass my legislation to codify Roe into law. Our democracy is on the ballot. I will fight to protect every American's right to vote. And our economy is on the ballot. I will keep fighting to lower costs and make sure your family has a fair shake.
At 23 years old, I walked into my husband's trauma care unit at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. I had student loan debt, I had a car payment, and he had tubes coming out of every orifice of his body. He was in a coma. And that was my first experience with the bureaucratic government system. And I fought for his life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. I took on big government and I won. He went on and became the first blind active duty officer to ever serve our country. We served for over a decade with him completely blind. And then I knew I had to go back and make it right for everyone else.
So I think both of these candidates have one particular weakness that continues to be hard for them to get past in a state like Washington. For Patty Murray, there is no doubt that the economy, for any Democrat running right now, Democratic incumbent, the economy is a challenging hurdle to get over. People are suffering economically, the cost of fuel, the cost of groceries, and they are the party in power. The president is of their party, and he has a really low approval rating. And so Murray is just, I think, going to continue to struggle to find a valid excuse for the issue of inflation.
Ms. Murray, what should Congress do to address rising costs? You have 90 seconds.
Such an important question. In every community I know, families are struggling. And like I told you in the beginning, I know what that feels like. So I have been very focused on lowering costs for families as we get through this global challenge that we are facing. I have worked to lower prescription drug costs. In the Inflation Reduction Act, the biggest reduction in prescription drugs we have ever seen, allowing Medicare to negotiate for lower prices.
Senator Murray stood with Joe Biden with the Inflation Reduction Act and said, this is going to help us. Don't be deceived by the name, because this isn't coming from me, this is coming from the CBO. It does nothing to combat inflation. In fact, it raises taxes on all of us.
Now, the issue that's hard for Tiffany Smiley in this is abortion. Patty Murray has gone to great lengths to paint Tiffany Smiley, who's pro-life, as an extremist. And you're seeing that abortion narrative in many other races, especially in swing districts against Republicans. I think Tiffany Smiley's answer on this is a good one, but Patty Murray, as far as Washington's electorate, I think has this issue on her side.
What would you want or not want to see in federal abortion legislation? Yes, I've been clear. I am personally pro-life. I think there's good people on both sides of this issue, and we need to be able to come into the center of this and acknowledge it. I've been clear from the very beginning. I oppose a federal abortion ban. That's long before the unprecedented leak from the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's decision gave the power to the people, and that's where I believe it belongs. I respect the will of the voters here in Washington State. So what I will do is ensure that women have access to health care, that they have access and affordable access to contraception and child care. Unlike Senator Murray, who's been there for the last 30 years, I'll go get that done for women. And when women are in a time of crisis, I want to ensure that they have every resource that they need, should they choose to keep their child, that they have every resource, that it's not a ticket to poverty or a lack of education. You know, there's one extreme on this issue, and it's Senator Murray, because if she had it her way, she would change the will of the voters of Washington State. Her record represents it. It would be taxpayer-funded, abortion on demand, all the way up to the point of birth. And the question we should all ask Senator Murray is, do you believe in any legal limitations to abortion?
There is a huge difference between me and my opponent on this issue. I believe that every woman should be able to make her own healthcare choices about her own family, working with her doctor, her faith, and her own needs. This should not be decided by politicians. You just heard my opponent say politicians should decide. I do not agree with that at all. We should not be in a room with people when they are making medical decisions. Now, I hear my opponent over there saying, I'm 100% pro-life, don't worry. I gotta tell you, I was in the Senate. I saw Supreme Court nominees come in front of us and say to us, I'm pro-life, don't worry, and look what happened. They overturned 50 years of precedent and put this country and women's lives in chaos.
You agree politicians should decide this. I said I believe that the people should, and I respect the will of the voters here in Washington State.
And look, Tiffany makes a good point. I think one of the things Republican candidates really need to do that perhaps they haven't been able to with quite as much success is to show that there are a lot of Democrats who have a view on abortion that is also extreme, but to the other end. You know, supporting no restrictions on abortion whatsoever. And I think that if they can be more intentional about, you know, talking about, sure, you might think that supporting a national ban on abortion or not supporting exceptions in the case of rape and incest is extreme. I certainly believe that's extreme. But on the other end, I also believe that allowing abortion up to the point of birth is extreme as well. So if you can kind of point out the two extremes and then talk about how you have a more reasonable approach to this issue, I think that that's successful for candidates of any party. I thought there was one moment in the debate, I had to laugh. The Seattle Times did this. I'm always dunking on the Seattle Times. But the Seattle Times did this article on the debate, and I had to laugh at this one line about Tiffany Smiley, where they said that she rose her voice at times. It's like, okay, it's not a debate, I guess. It's a candidate forum. But they pointed out that she rose her voice at times. Like, okay, I guess I don't understand that. I guess both of them are passionate about the issues. It's just funny. I'm not like one of those people who screams sexism, but would you really say something about a man raising his voice? Is it because Tiffany Smiley's a woman? I don't know. But there was this question about January 6th, which I believe is a relevant question. I believe absolutely should be included in the conversation. And certainly it's an opportunity for Patty Murray to speak out against the politics of Donald Trump. And she'll try to obviously paint Tiffany Smiley into that corner as well. So first, let me play Patty Murray's answer to the question about January 6th.
I will not ever forget that day. I walked away from a terrifically horrible situation and realized for the first time in my life that our democracy doesn't happen just because you think it's there. Our democracy is something you have to fight for. We can never allow brute force to take over our votes or our voices. I will fight every day to make sure that we never allow those people who continue the big lie, including my opponent on her website before she changed it in July, to question that election, because that sows mistrust in our country for our democracy. It is critical that we hold everyone accountable and never allow our democracy to be taken away. We have to fight for it. I'm going to fight for it. And I want our country to know that this is a critical issue in this election.
And Tiffany Smiley had just such an exceptional retort to that. I really thought it was the highlight of the debate for any of the candidates.
I want to be clear on this. My husband lost his eyesight fighting for our country. He's here in this debate listening to us. He lost his eyesight fighting for democracy. And our family lives with that sacrifice every single day. It's certainly why I'm in this fight as well. And so I want to ask, you know, do you believe that me and my family are a threat to democracy, Senator Murray? Because tell everyone here today, either that or disavow your campaign's dangerous rhetoric that has spent millions of dollars to attack and paint me as someone I am not.
And of course, after that, Patty Murray, I think rightfully, took a moment to kind of thank Tiffany Smiley and her family for their service and try to defuse the situation.
I will say first to my opponent, no one questions her belief in our democracy or her husband's fight for our country, ever.
So anyway, I thought Tiffany Smiley held her own. Again, I didn't think that this format really allowed for a lot of in-depth questioning, fact-checking, pressing the candidates on the issues, which is really important. But they covered a lot of ground. I'll give the moderator credit. I did like the last question, the question they ended with, because it's very true to this show, and that is what they're going to do if elected in November to bridge the political divides that we have in this country.
If elected, explain how you would work with the other party and those who did not vote for you. Ms. Smiley, we'll start with you.
Yes, I am happy to work. I mean, look at my track record of building coalitions and taking on big government. You know, Senator Murray has put millions of dollars behind me to smear me. And she shows you the picture of me and Donald Trump, but she doesn't show you the picture of me and her, because that's who I am. I will work with anyone to deliver results. Senator Murray wants to scare you. I'm here to serve you. I'm here to ensure that we rebuild our reputation in Washington State, that people want to come here because it's the best place
Thank
to get
you,
an education
Smiley.
And work. I'd be honored to earn your vote.
Thank you. Ms. Murray, you have 30 seconds.
I am proud to work with anyone in the Senate who works for Washington State families with me. That's why I worked to do the budget agreement with Paul Ryan when government was shut down and no one else could get us an agreement to move forward. I passed a bill with Lamar Alexander, my Republican counterpart, to change No Child Left Behind so our kids could learn at school in a way that wasn't testing them every day. And right now, I am working with my Republican counterparts to pass a Prevent Pandemics Act to assure that we never go through what
Thank
we
you,
went
Ms.
through
Murray.
Again. That's why I ask for your vote and your support.
We're going to have some in-depth coverage of this race coming up on Friday's podcast. And it is a race that, according to polls, continues to narrow. There was a poll commissioned by the Seattle Times and some partners that showed that Smiley made up 10 points in this race. Now Murray only holds an 8-point lead. And that's fluctuated a little bit in the last few months. I don't know how much I really believe in polls. I mean, we've seen them be just dramatically wrong. But the nation continues to watch this race, and we are certainly going to continue to watch it as well. Okay, moving right along. Gosh, I'm just letting you guys know, I don't feel good today. One of the downsides of working for yourself is that you really can't take a sick day. I mean, if I don't do the show, who's going to do the show? I've had these sinus issues from all the wildfire smoke for several months now. I need to see a doctor because it's just getting worse. My nose hurts. It's like tender to the touch. Anyway, I tell you guys everything. So I just thought I'd let you know that I'm not feeling great today, but the show must go on. I posted a couple exclusives over the weekend in our Sunday newsletter. I had got some tips on a couple things, and so I included all that in our Sunday newsletter. And one of them had to do with the King County prosecutor's race. I believe this is, as far as Washington State goes, the most important race on the November ballot, because you have Seattle dealing with this immense crime issue, the surrounding cities dealing with, you know, record high homicide rates and other rises in violent crime. And there's this question of whether, you know, prosecutors are really living up to their end of the bargain to hold violent criminals accountable. So the race is pitting what I would say are, generally speaking, two people who I don't think they're incredibly ideologically opposed to one another. You know, they're not on the extreme ends, but they have a lot of different opinions about how to approach the crime crisis. So Lisa Mannion is the current chief of staff for the King County Prosecutor's Office. So she's running to replace her boss, Dan Satterberg, who's not running for re-election. And then Federal Way Mayor Jim Farrell, who most people assume is going to be a kind of more tough on crime person. He is running for the position as well. So I did this story over the weekend, again, that was on the newsletter. If you haven't seen it, you can find it on Patreon or Locals. There's no paywall on it. About how Lisa Mannion had to, or didn't have to, but did issue an apology for something she said. So over the weekend, Lisa Mannion sent an email to staffers at the King County Prosecutor's Office. And a little bit of context here. So she had, on October 20th, there was a candidate form between Lisa Mannion and Jim Farrell. And Lisa Mannion was trying to defend her lack of trial experience. So she doesn't have actual trial experience, and Jim Farrell does. And so she has been dinged for that. And the point she was trying to make, and I'll play the clip here for you momentarily, but the point she was trying to make is, look, I'm running to be the prosecutor. The prosecutor isn't in the courtroom. And so my lack of trial experience doesn't really matter if I want to be the King County prosecutor. But here's how she worded it.
Talking about
are not electing me to stand in the courtroom. Right. I can do that tomorrow.
We have brand new lawyers, fresh out of law school, who go to trial. I have 27 years of experience. You know, the CEO of Amazon's not putting the labels on the boxes, and they're not driving the trucks, right?
So I heard from a deputy King County prosecuting attorney who told me that folks in the office were livid when they saw that because they really found it to be demeaning, and that Lisa Mannion, you know, suggesting, oh, I could step into a courtroom tomorrow, and then comparing the work of line prosecutors to the people who put labels on boxes and deliver Amazon packages as opposed to the CEO of Amazon. So kind of comparing herself like to a CEO who doesn't have to do like the menial work. This deputy prosecutor didn't want their name used, but told me with morale at an all-time low and caseloads at an all-time high, prosecutors were shocked and angered to learn of their trial work being trivialized by Lisa Mannion. The deputy prosecutor went on to say, victims are not cardboard boxes. The work is demanding and requires skill, experience, dedication, and compassion. So Lisa Mannion, and this wasn't in the public, what she said, like there was no press coverage or public outrage that I'm aware of over what she said. So I take this to mean that there was some internal outrage. And so she issued an email to prosecutors. She wrote, "Dear colleagues, I have learned that a comment I made during an evening non-work-related event hurt and offended many of you, and I want to apologize. During the event, I made a remark stating something to the effect of how the CEO of Amazon does not put labels on boxes or drive trucks. I made this comment in an attempt to put into context for a lay audience, in what I intended to be a relatable example, my 27 years of experience at the PAO, Prosecuting Attorney's Office. I now realize that my comment was inartful and clumsy and hurt and offended many of my colleagues because it was received as if I was discounting or dismissing the many contributions, sacrifices, and hard work of our employees as either menial or unimportant. That was not at all my intent, and I am truly sorry that this was the impact on many. I stepped in it, and I'm sorry." Now, I was pretty torn on whether to do something on this because I do agree that it was a very inartful example, but I'm not big on kind of demanding apologies for every little thing. And I don't think that, I mean, she did obviously reach out and apologize without there being kind of media pressure for her to do so. And I think that's a good thing. And it's an apology that really made no excuse for it. I definitely think the comparison was demeaning. And so I was kind of either way on it. But then, you know, when I heard from that senior deputy prosecutor, I was like, you know, that is a good point, where the senior deputy prosecutor says, look, morale in our office is at an all-time low. We have these, you know, impossible caseloads. Crime is out of control. We're under a lot of public pressure, staffing shortages. And for Lisa Mannion to talk about our work in this way only hurts morale. And I do agree with that sentiment. It's like if you had the chief of police or a candidate for the chief of police basically saying, oh, I could go out and respond to 911 calls any day, but I have more important work to do at a time when officers are demoralized. And so I think it leads to questions about if Lisa Mannion's elected, does she have the trust of her prosecutors? Does she have the respect of her prosecutors who she clearly offended in this way and trivialized their work unintentionally, but that's what it served to do. So I'm curious to get your thoughts on this. So respond here in the comments about whether you think that this is something she should have apologized for, whether you think it's something that was worthy of our coverage of it, whether you think it does serve to hurt morale of prosecutors, et cetera, et cetera. So I want to hear from you on this one. Oh boy, did I piss members of Seattle's LGBTQ plus community off over the weekend. Wasn't my intention really, but you know, apparently they've got some folks who are very sensitive to just me in general, I think, but particularly the Seattle Pride Organization. So the Seattle Pride Organization, you know, advocates on behalf of LGBTQ plus issues. They also put on the annual Pride Parade. And you may recall, I had the executive director, Crystal Marks, on for a lengthy interview in June because they had ditched Amazon as a sponsor because Amazon had given money to some Republican candidates. And you know, Seattle Pride and other Pride organizations have also in the past, not Seattle Pride, but other Pride organizations, I think Capitol Hill Pride, had, you know, said that police officers weren't welcome. Oh, and Seattle Pride didn't want police to officially march in the Pride. So it was like this month of inclusion, and they were excluding like anyone who'd had any tangential tie to Republicans, and then cops weren't welcome. And it was like, that's so counter to the month, right? So anyway, I think they're mad at me for my coverage of that, but that's okay. Now, I consider myself an ally. I have many friends who are supporting the LGBTQ plus community. I am supportive of trans rights as human rights, although I've been very critical and skeptical of any sort of gender affirming care for youth, and also taking parental rights and decision-making away when it comes to youth making decisions about gender-affirming care or hormone therapy, etc. So anyway, I did this story again in my newsletter. It was a very meaty newsletter this week, so you have to go back and read it. And the title of it was, "You'll Never Be Woke Enough." Back in 2020, when all the crazy defunding stuff was happening, and it just felt like these policies were being thrown out with any without any criticality, just to please like the loudest voice in the room, I had said at the time that, you know, liberal Democrats, moderate Democrats should be thoughtful about just jumping on board with anything the progressives wanted, just to appease them or to ingratiate themselves to them. Because my point was, look, they're going to primary you one day anyway. You know, people like Congressman Adam Smith, who's a Democrat, who's, I would consider him moderate. I mean, maybe, you know, left of middle. But, you know, he'll do things and say things, I think, to please the progressive base. But they're going to come, they've already come after a seat before. They're going to do it again. So my point to them was just, you know, be who you are. Don't try to overplease the far left wing of your party, because at the end of the day, they're not going to leave you alone. They're not going to leave your seat alone. Like, they are going to come for your seat, especially in those districts where Republicans really don't have a chance. Then it'll just come down to Democrat on Democrat. So anyway, so that was my point. And this sort of solidified that for me. So Seattle Pride released its 2022 voter guide, where it asked candidates to submit answers to four questions, and then it would rate them based on how friendly, how involved, how many good ideas that candidate has when it comes to helping advance interests of the LGBTQIA plus community. So the four questions were this: in what ways have you supported the LGBTQIA plus community? If reelected or elected, how will you advance the rights of LGBTQIA plus? There's a lot of letters on that now, individuals in your purview. The third question, LGBTQIA plus youth, especially transgender youth, are at an increased risk for suicide, depression, bullying, and housing insecurity. How will you use your office to fight for these youth? And the final question was, LGBTQIA plus residents have disproportionately experienced homelessness and housing insecurity, which the COVID-19 pandemic has exacerbated, particularly for queer and trans BIPOC residents. How will you use your office to champion housing security for such residents? So, based on the answers, Seattle Pride ranked these candidates anywhere from zero pride flags to four pride flags. So zero being like, this person hates gay people. Four being like, they are the epitome of like an ally. They're getting stuff done for our community. They have great ideas, etc. I was really shocked that not one Democrat, progressive, liberal, moderate, got four flags. We are in Seattle. We are, I don't know if there is a city more welcoming of the LGBTQ plus community. I don't know if there's a city that has done more to work toward equality. And I was looking, I mean, there was like one Republican who answered and they gave him like 1/8 of a flag, and that didn't surprise me. But for all the other Democrats, just as an example, House Speaker Lori Jenkins, she is the first lesbian Speaker of the House. She's been working on advancing issues around equality for 30 years in Washington State. She got three flags. And I'm just like, what more could someone do, right? what more do you want from them? And then the one that really got me was Senator Jamie Peterson, who, this is someone who, if not for him, marriage equality might not have happened when it did in Washington State. Like, he was a driving force behind giving gay people in our state the right to marry. He got 2.9 flags. I was like, what more could someone do? You know? And I was like, he didn't write very much in response to his answers. But I'm like, does he really need to continue to prove that he is like a steadfast ally who will do whatever it takes to achieve equality? What else do you need from him? And like, what does that mean for the rest of us? Like I said, I consider myself an ally. I believe in equality for all. But they would give me definitely zero flags because I've questioned gender-affirming care for teenagers and cutting parents out of that care. So I just thought my kind of takeaway message was that if these people don't even get, if they're getting like a piddly 2.9 rating, just be yourself. Focus on things you care about and don't worry about being woke enough. Because if they're not woke enough for Seattle Pride, the rest of us don't have a chance in hell. The following segment is presented in partnership with Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. A follow-up for you today on a story we did about Camp Hope. So Camp Hope is a homeless camp in the city of Spokane. It might have up to 400 people. And it's been just, I think, like the poster child homeless camp for government dysfunction. It's a homeless camp that sits on property owned by the Washington State Department of Transportation. And so you have, you know, the Spokane County Sheriff who wants it cleared. You have the mayor of Spokane who says that they want to do more to deal with it, but their hands are tied because technically these people are on state property. And so they all need to work together. And as you know, the government doesn't function well when people need to work together. And so that's why I was so annoyed. And I feel like every single voter, every single taxpayer of Washington should be annoyed by this. To see how the blame game around this played out behind the scenes. So I had submitted a public disclosure request to the governor's office that was kind of unrelated, tangentially tied to Camp Hope. It's for a story I'm working on. But I found some emails in it that showed the extent to which state agencies were working behind the scenes to try to shift blame over this camp to the city of Spokane and to Mayor Nadine Woodward, who's a Republican. Now, whether that has to do with the desire to shift blame onto her and to the city, I can't say for sure. But let's just say I'm sure that the governor's office isn't the biggest fan of the mayor of Spokane. And behind the scenes, they were, you know, one, insulting her, and I'll talk about who in a moment, but insulting her ability to lead, insulting a member of the media who was covering this story, and trying to fine-tune a statement to release to reporters that would put the blame where they feel like it belongs on the city of Spokane. This from a communications director with the Washington State Department of Transportation. The mayor continues to change her narrative, re the encampment, and shift blame on Commerce or WashDOT, depending on the day. I think it's time we fire back and start setting the record straight. Otherwise, that narrative will become what the public thinks is the truth. And we know that's not the case. Now, if you recall, we had Spokane's mayor on the show to talk about this particular camp and where she thinks blame sits for it. Would the city even, if they had full control over it, been able to do more than the state has done?
Absolutely. I mean, we would have been able to expand our shelter system before it got to the point where there were 600 individuals to move people from that encampment and into emergency shelter.
Explain
but now
that
when you've got 600 individuals, it makes it a lot harder.
Okay. So if the city had been in control of it, you wouldn't have let it get to that point, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
So the state has a different opinion. The state believes that it is the city's fault that this camp exists to begin with. So the state notes that Camp Hope technically originated from a protest that was happening at Spokane City Hall. And the protest was over this perceived belief that the city wasn't doing enough to provide beds and housing and social services for people who were experiencing homelessness in the city. So when that protest was disrupted by the city of Spokane, you had these people go over to the property that belongs to the state that is now Camp Hope. And so it's the state's contention that, look, had the city of Spokane done more to offer services to these homeless individuals, then Camp Hope never would have started to begin with. And so that's why the state is saying in these emails that the mayor continues to change her narrative, read the encampment, and shift blame on Commerce or WashDOT, depending on the day. I think it's time we fire back and start setting the record straight. So behind the scenes, WashDOT, the Office of Financial Management, the governor's office started trying to put together a statement to release to the media, shifting blame back on the city for this after the city had shifted blame to the state. So anyway, they end up with a statement they're all happy about that they released to the media, doing just that. A spokesperson for the governor emails a member of the governor's senior leadership team saying, Drew, sharing for your awareness, given legislator interest in all this, the mayor is trying to throw our agencies under the bus on the problems she created, and we've given thumbs up to WashDOT to set the record straight. Here's the thing. I don't care how the camp got there at this stage. I don't care what agency gets blamed for it. I don't care, frankly, what agency fixes it. The only thing that matters right now is that the camp is addressed and that we try to prevent a similar camp from forming in Spokane, from forming along I-5, in the Seattle area, down I-90. All of these agencies ought to be laser focused on dealing with the underlying issues that are making our homelessness crisis worse by the day. And instead, what are they doing? They are bickering amongst themselves. They are trying to shift blame. They are spending valuable days and hours and minutes formulating statements that put the blame on a different entity so they don't have to accept any blame themselves. And I tell you, that is not leadership. Now, the city of Spokane and Spokane County have a good argument to make that their hands are tied when it comes to dealing with Camp Hope in its current form. That is WashDOT property, and it is the responsibility of the state to deal with it. That is a fact. Now, they can spend time bickering back and forth about whether the city of Spokane allowed these people to go out there, allowed it to get as bad as it did. But frankly, Washingtonians really don't give a damn. Not to mention in their emails trying to decide how do we word this statement to put blame where we feel like it belongs, the city of Spokane. Here you have people who are very high up in the governor's office, in these state agencies, openly insulting in these emails that they know are subject to public disclosure. A member of the media who is working on the story related to Camp Hope, and directly the mayor of Spokane. I'll read these two emails for you. Penny Thomas with the Commerce Department is sending an email to folks with the State Patrol, with the governor's office, with OFM. In it, she is talking about reporters who have reached out about this story, who they're going to send a statement to. She writes, "We've also spoken a couple times with Daniel Walters at the Inlander." Inlander is like the alt weekly in Spokane. Although he did a pretty lame interview, no bad coverage, just a poor interview with Lisa, and hasn't been reaching out regularly for updates. And then you have the director of the Office of Financial Management, who's responding to a news story done by Jonathan Cho about Camp Hope. That story featured Spokane Mayor Nadine Woodward. And David Schumacher, again, the director of OFM, writes in response to the story, "G-Mayor, governing is tough. Go figure." Now, here's why that little jab at the Spokane mayor bothers me. Around the exact same time that the head of OFM was insulting her ability to govern, the Department of Transportation put out a statement to the media suggesting that the state and the city of Spokane were having productive conversations about how to move forward with the situation, saying yesterday's meeting with city officials was a start to productive, much-needed discussion to successfully resolve Camp Hope and work together. So while the state is saying, oh, we're having productive conversations, the director of OFM is behind the scenes like a 14-year-old teenager gossiping, insulting the Spokane mayor's ability to lead, ability to govern. And we're supposed to believe that these are the people who have the knowledge, who have the expertise, who have the wherewithal to solve a crisis that has been vexing our state for years. Get real. The preceding segment was brought to you in partnership with Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. We hear a lot from Democrats that they feel like they're the party that cares about people of color, that cares about the gay community, that cares about women, and that Republicans are anti-BIPOC community, anti-gay, anti-women. But, you know, what I've come to really believe is that that only applies for Democrats if you have people of color, gay people, women who are falling in line with the Democratic Party. You know, we talked earlier about an example of, you know, during Pride Month in Seattle, about Seattle Pride cutting ties with Amazon because they had given money to campaigns of some Republicans. And so again, it was like, oh, we support people who are gay, but not if you're a Republican, is how that read to me. There are a few other examples of that this week. So Ron Filipowski is like this very like anti-right wing, that's like his brand, right? Twitter guy. And he used to be a Republican, but then he flipped over. And now all he does is sort of document the workings of the right wing, as he calls it. Well, he posted this picture of Kimberly Guilfoyle, who, of course, used to be married to Gavin Newsom, but now she is the partner of Donald Trump Jr. So he posts this picture of her at some photo shoot, it looks like, and she's wearing this dress. And he writes, "This drag queen stuff is getting out of hand." Okay. So here's someone who says he's taking on the right wing and he's insulting a woman, saying that she looks like a drag queen. And every who's who of Democrats and left-leaning pundits are piling on about her appearance. So what happened to caring about women? What happened to valuing women? Because clearly here you're demeaning a woman, calling her a saying she looks like a drag queen. And you're doing it because she's a Republican. So you don't actually care about women. You don't actually value women. You value women who are Democrats. And if that's the case, just be honest about that. But you can't claim to be the party who values that values women when you treat women you don't agree with like this. Now, there was another example of this sort of sentiment this week. Do you remember Jemele Hill, who was like a sports commentator? Well, now she's like deep into politics. So there was this article from NBC News that said, talked about how Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, his popularity among Latinos is really high in Florida, and particularly South Florida, saying that he could win Miami-Dade County. And that's something that a Republican governor has not done in Florida for 20 years. But Jemele Hill sent out this story, and she wrote on Twitter, "That proximity to whiteness is a real thing. Also reminds me of an adage I heard a long time ago about how the oppressed begin to take on the traits of the oppressor." So she's talking about how these Latinos are aligning themselves with whiteness, or in this case, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, and how they are oppressed people who are aligning themselves with their oppressor. So in her view, again, she thinks these Latinos who support Ron DeSantis are dumb, that they're not smart enough to make an informed decision about who they support politically, that they must not know any better, that they must not know that someone like Ron DeSantis isn't working in their interests. You tell me how that is being supportive of communities of color. So again, you're only supportive of Latinos if they are supportive of you. That, in my estimation, is not being supportive of communities of color. The way to support communities of color would be to listen to their concerns, to listen to what they want in elected leaders, to respect their decisions when it comes to who they decide to vote for, to not treat them like they're idiots. And if they don't support you, if they do support someone like Governor Ron DeSantis, to try to figure out why, to ask them, to get to the bottom of why they support Ron DeSantis as opposed to supporting a Democrat. And then when you find the real answer, work to address their needs and to earn their vote. But instead, no. You say you care about people of color, you vilify people of color who don't support you, you say you care about women, you degrade and demean women who don't support you. So the Democratic Party can talk all it wants about it being the party for BIPOC people, it being the party for women's rights. But until it can stop this sentiment in its ranks, I don't want to hear it at all. Okay. Get some viewer comments on. I did a commentary the other day talking about why I get in the mud with Twitter trolls, because I think it's a scary ordeal for a lot of people in the middle to expose themselves to that level of scrutiny. And I'm like, hell no, I don't care. I'm already there, so I'll fight with them. But I talked about that. Encourage you guys not to get Twitter if you haven't already. I'll read a couple of your messages. Nadine says, "I came to the conclusion that it's none of my business what people think of me. Great inner peace." I like that, Nadine. Shaheen says, "I love your show and the message you send out. Haters gonna hate. Just stay truthful as you always are. Big hugs." Thank you for the hugs. Lenora said, "Good for you. I'm glad you're brave enough to stand up to the bullies. I left Twitter a year or so ago." I'm jealous, Lenora. I'm gonna have to wait till retirement. Let's see, a few more of them. You guys made me feel better about it. Joanne says, "How have you not gotten kicked off? Everyone I know that was on got kicked off." I don't know. I got, remember, suspended from Twitter once, or from Facebook once, but Facebook apologized because it was by accident, because I hadn't actually violated their rules. James says, I'm part of the silent majority for that reason, for the reason that if you speak out, you're vilified, you're labeled, you're called a racist, whatever. So I appreciate you guys' support on that issue. But hopefully I encourage some of you to be willing to get into the fray. You don't have to do it to the extent that I do. But when you have the fringes that are the minority but are so freaking loud because they don't care about the consequences of things they say. Usually they're not even using their picture and their profile. They're not even using their real names. And so they just bogart the conversation. We, the reasonable people that span the middle of the political spectrum, have to be willing to speak out, regardless of our fear for what might follow. All right, that's it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. See, I made it through the show, even though I've got my nasal passage issues. I'm going to see a doctor about it, I promise. If you have not become an Undivided subscriber already, now is a great time right before the election to do so. We'll have a live Q&A that's exclusive to subscribers in the coming days. You can answer your burning questions about the election. But to do that, you have to become a subscriber either on Patreon or Locals, patreon.com/undivided, or you can become a contributor on my Locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. Undivided is presented by our founding sponsor, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com.